You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, June 8th. 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Seether, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Alex Salmon, staff writer at the American Prospect, is here to talk about his piece, The RNC's Ground Game of Inches. And later in the show, Joe Eskenazi, managing editor of Mission Local, joins us to discuss the successful recall vote of San Francisco DA Chesa Boudin. Meanwhile, Meanwhile, he was unfortunately recalled after a very well-funded sabotage campaign from Republicans and real estate developers and the police department. Helped out too. Also in California, Representative Karen Bass and billionaire Republican businessman Rick Caruso, now running as a tough on crime Democrat, are projected to advance to a runoff in the race for LA mayor. In better news, reformist candidate Kimberly Graham has won the primary in the race for prosecutor of Iowa's Polk County. The Kabuki theater of gun control negotiations continue in the Senate. Schumer wants Democrats to take a smaller deal now and push for more later. There won't even be a smaller deal now. That's going to be nothing, I think. Somalia is facing the country's worst drought in four decades. Now mass famine is the fear. Steve Bannon got indicted on two counts of contempt of Congress in the fall, so now he's subpoenaing the entire January 6th committee and Nancy Pelosi herself. Best offense is a good defense? No. Best defense is a good offense. That's what I meant. And lastly, Moderna is reporting that its revised vaccine works better against Omicron, but no word on whether the updated formula will work for future versions of the virus. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen, everybody. Hope you're having a good hump day. Sam's out, as you probably may have noticed by this point. I apologize if I ducked out. I ducked out yesterday. Like just an intense situation medically, but it's not that bad. I don't even know why I'm like getting into it. It's fine. I was okay. I got sick, but I feel fine today. Sam is out for a dental emergency, so we're just falling apart here at the seams.
It's like a team making their way through the playoffs and just the veterans are going down like flies.
I know. Matt was trying to find like an apt comparison. I would say it's almost like the Rangers, who lost pretty much three players over the past 48 hours. But we could also be the Brooklyn Nets.
I like to say the Milwaukee Bucks, because then I'm Giannis.
by height. Yeah. By height. And also because you are a narcissist and view yourself as the main character.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm PJ Tucker.
I think I could be Chris Middleton.
Yeah, I agree.
All right. That's who works for me.
Sam's Thanasis.
Pat Connaughton.
With that said, yesterday at the on Capitol Hill at the White House, Matthew McConaughey spoke to the press corps about the shooting in Uvalde. Now, I have mixed feelings about this. He's a good communicator here, but it seems, from all accounts, he's more conservative politically. So this is the Biden administration doing what they always do, finding a conservative that is going to be the reasonable. And I don't know how conservative he is, but it's not like he's a Marxist people, right?
Yeah, so, he was hedging on when it looked like he might run. He was hedging a little bit on gun control. I mean, but also, I mean, this happened. Uvalde is close to where he was, where he grew up.
So that's the positive value of it. And I think also the fact that he's a strong speaker and he was super emotional during this speech, rhetorically, I'm all for that. I am frustrated by the impulse to constantly prop up the more reasonable type of conservative in order to somehow shame a Republican Party that is without shame. And two, I'm also frustrated by this impulse of Democrats to outsource their messaging to anybody, right? Does Trump outsource his messaging to anybody? No, he's the guy. He's going to be the one that says things. He barely gives time to his surrogates. And I think that's more effective. The country thinks Biden's invisible right now. I don't think outsourcing your leadership or your messaging to others is the way to go for him politically. And I want Democrats to have success in the fall. With that said, though, these words from McConaughey were powerful.
Get that food truck together. We also met a cosmetologist. Right? She was well-versed in mortuary makeup. That's the task of making the victims appear as peaceful and natural as possible for their open casket viewings. These bodies were very different. They needed much more than makeup to be presentable. They needed extensive restoration. Why? Due to the exceptionally large exit wounds of an AR-15 rifle. Most of the bodies so mutilated that only DNA test or green Converse could identify. Many children were left not only dead but hollow. So yes, counselors are going to be needed in Uvalde for a long time. Counselors are needed in all these places where these mass shooters have been for a long time. I was told by many that it takes a good year before people even understand what to do next. And even then, when they become secure enough to take the first step forward, a lifetime's.
I mean, of course. He spoke powerfully, and he referenced there the green Converse, which was a moment when he was speaking where he got emotional, because that was the only way that police were able to identify one of the victims, a pair of green Converse that had a heart drawn on them. I mean, it's gut-wrenching. And there is value, despite, you know, my reservations, in having a talented communicator speak in that way about those issues, and a resident of a nearby community growing up in Texas.
Yeah, I mean, your fundamental frustration, I think, is shared with this is being made about basically like a cultural push instead of a policy push, which is very Democrat to do. Mm. That said, if we're going to do the culture thing, like, I was surprised at how much I watched a few of the McConaughey clips, and I appreciated him up there in place of, you know, frankly, the normal liar that they have running White House press stuff, typically, like
the person who is paid to lie.
Exactly. Like,
then gets cushy media jobs.
And
after.
Like, I don't know. Like, it's tough. You say, like, is this going to cause a cultural shift? And it's like, well, how many cultural shifts is it going to take?
Yeah.
Because we've had a bunch of cultural shifts that seem as momentous as this. But then you grant that this one does feel like there's some feels different about a lot of these, and then nothing changes.
But, like, cultural shifts are not replacements for political victories.
Exactly, yeah.
It's just, you know,
they're supposed to signal future victories.
Exactly.
And then we never get to that point. It's like our whole generation learned, like, oh, yeah, this Obamacare thing, it's a step towards universal health care. That's literally why I was excited about Obama back when I was a college student. And then you'd find out, like, actually a lot of the coalition is not about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't know what more ways we can communicate these issues to Republicans. I mean, the doctor, we don't need to play this right now, but the doctor who treated the Uvalde victims says, quote, you know, Oh, this was the wrong clip, actually. Good, so we don't have, but I sent the wrong clip. Just spoke about how the graphic imagery of children that were decapitated, their bodies mangled beyond recognition, flesh intermixed. I'm sorry, but this is the reality. Flesh intermixed with cartoon characters on their t-shirts and their clothing. And, like, there's no way to communicate to these people that the brutality has reached a certain threshold. Public opinion is technically on the Democrat side, but it is not a galvanizing issue on election day. So what you have to do is seize power. Every executive order that Biden can do, he should do. And at the same time, you should be out there every single day shaming Republicans, as opposed to searching in your couch cushions for the one Republican or conservative coded person like Matthew McConaughey from Texas who's going to communicate these issues to shame Republicans into doing the right thing. That's not the way this works. The only way they'll come with their tails tucked between their fascist legs is if you beat them and you win. And frankly, the coalition and the that Biden has compiled is not up to that task. Nor is the Democratic Party as currently constructed, which is why we have to change that party. But, like, this is why someone like Kamala Harris, who's not visible at all, and frankly is not a talented communicator, was such a terrible pick. Because we know that Biden is older, struggles to communicate at this point in his life, has in the past, but sometimes has moments where you're like, that guy was very good.
Well, also, I think the issue, too, is they kind of are, like we were saying, I think it's kind of a normie take to be like, let Biden be Biden. But I think there's something to it. Like, I think that where he's the most effective was when he's kind of off the cuff. And a lot of his aides and advisors just kind of rein him in every time he does it recently.
Yeah, he should do more of that. And but you know, that's what just, I guess, another wrinkle in my frustration with this impulse is that you could have had a talented communicator in that secondary slot who would have built something in terms of like a future party candidate, say Biden doesn't run in 24 or 28, whatever. There could have been somebody who has that ability to speak to these issues like McConaughey is doing right there. But instead, you got to bring in a celebrity because the Democratic Party is just lost right now. With that said, we have a word from our sponsors. Now, free email servers like Gmail and Yahoo aren't really free. Did you know this? They're not. You pay with your privacy. Internet giants exploit your data by selling it to the highest bidder, but with StartMail, you can feel safe again. StartMail keeps your email private. Every email can be encrypted, even if the recipient doesn't use encryption. I mean, this is, you know, perfect, especially for us. We're trying to maintain a level of privacy because we're on the internet, but for you, for everyday people who want to keep their, I mean, I just anecdotally,
if
I've
you're just had to cut you off, but if you're, for instance, like organizing your workplace, do not use company email.
This would be perfect for that. And I've just been seeing so many people, friends, mutual friends, people from high school and social media being like, I just got hacked. There's been so much of this and so much of people's personal data being breached that this kind of thing is perfect. StartMail. StartMail keeps your email private. Every email can be encrypted, even if the recipient doesn't use encryption. When you delete an email in StartMail, it's gone forever. Switching to StartMail is seamless. Transfer all your current email data instead of starting from scratch. StartMail uses their own servers and is backed by the most stringent privacy laws in the world. With StartMail, you get unlimited anonymous aliases. So when you're giving your email to a company but want to protect your identity, StartMail can generate a shareable alias email that can be deleted at any time. Now, this is helpful for Sam, who has a million emails. Now he's able to just streamline this process. Start securing your email privacy with StartMail. Sign up today, and you'll get 50% off your first year. That's a great deal. Go to startmail.com/majority. That's StartMail with a T. StartMail. START startmail.com/majority for 50% off your first year. startmail.com/majority. Now, Sam, this is not my title, but this is Sam's title in his place. Lord Sam Cedar. And now he's being super weird about it. He's making us call him that in the office. Milord, do you need anything from the commissary? Milord, shut up! That's how he talks to us. But you can too feel like a lord with established titles, or lady. Established Titles is a project based on the historic Scottish custom, where landowners are called lords and ladies. Established Titles allows you to ceremonially purchase as little as 1 square foot of dedicated land in Aberdeenshire, Scotland. That's a very, very Scottish name. So that you can call yourself a lord or lady. But, like, not just for fun. It is fun, but officially. You get an official certificate with a crest and unique plot number. And they let you see exactly where your plot is located. The best part is, for each one sold, Established Titles plants a tree to protect the beautiful, pristine woodlands of Scotland. We're going to have Alex Salmon on in a bit. And last time he was on with me, we were discussing the deforestation of Europe. This is a really excellent way and fun way to counteract some of that. They also partner with organizations doing environmentalism work all over the world, like One Tree Planted and Trees for the Future. So Established Titles is a fun, novel way to help preserve the picturesque woodlands and biodiversity of Scotland while supporting global afforestation efforts. It makes a great last-minute gift, especially with Father's Day coming up soon. Reminds me. I've got to do that. Established Titles is running a big Father's Day sale right now, and you'll get an additional 10% off when you go to establishedtitles.com/majority. establishedtitles.com/majority. And use code MAJORITY. That's establishedtitles.com/majority. Coupon code MAJORITY saves you an extra 10%. The link is in the description. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we will bring in Alex Salmon. Are back. Welcome back to the show, Alex Salmon, staff writer at the American Prospect. We're going to be discussing your piece, the RNC's Ground Game of Inches, but I encourage everybody to read all of your work. Alex, thank you so much for being here. Back again.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. So last time you were here, we were talking about your great investigative piece into deforestation in Europe, Eastern Europe, I believe. And you faced a lot of, intimidation, sometimes threat of violence in that reporting. And what was interesting to me, it came to mind when I was reading your piece here in on the RNC, is that you were also facing, not to the same extent, but significant pushback for your reporting on and softer intimidation when you were trying to look into the genesis of these RNC community centers that are cropping up across the country. I mean, was that somewhat of a surreal experience?
Yeah, it was interesting because at first I thought that I was just, you know, doing a bad job of getting the right person on the phone or emailing the wrong, you know, the wrong account or whatever. And then, you know, after a while, I realized that, you know, obviously they were giving me the runaround and that, you know, there was a reason no one was calling me back. There was a reason no one would speak to me. And it was part of this kind of broader regime of secrecy that has governed the RNC's approach to this community center model. So, yeah, it was, you know, it was funny. It was one of those things where that trend didn't really dawn on me until very late into the reporting process, where I realized that there is a reason that you don't see any reporting about this. There's a reason that they won't talk to reporters, and there's a reason that they were so hostile to me when I showed up there.
So let's start from the beginning then. I mean, I also thought of your piece when I saw recently poll numbers that had come out about Biden's support among Black voters waning. And this is a trend that Republicans are very eager to capitalize on. They want to break into whenever they see any crack in the Democratic coalition, they're trying to shave off some of those voters, frankly, which is logical and makes sense. And let's just start there, really. How are they trying to do that with these community centers? And what did you find at the start of your reporting?
Yeah, so this kind of starts out in the 2020 election, and obviously the election returns there after Biden won. There's a lot of enthusiasm about the 7 million vote victory, you know, this huge margin that he ran up. But there was a lot of stuff in that data that was really concerning. And, you know, Biden did much worse with Latino voters than Hillary had done 4 years prior. He did worse with Black voters. He did worse with Asian voters. He did worse with Native American voters. And to a degree that I think even the Republican Party surprised itself by how well it did with those minority groups, because obviously the party has gotten more and more kind of unequivocally racist in a lot of ways, and yet is attracting more and more minority voters. And so that was kind of the point of intrigue for me is, you know, how can we explain how this is happening? Why is a party that is so, you know, hostile to non-white Americans bringing them into the fold so effectively? And the community center model is one of, you know, it's just one of many, you know, approaches that they're trying. And so they have, you know, set up this, they've set up centers now. I think there are probably 24 of them, but it's really hard to pin down because there, you know, isn't even a website that lists them all. In non-white communities all over the country, they're targeting specific racial groups, and they're doing a lot of sort of outreach to those groups on very basic economic and social needs. So they're doing, you know, pizza night, and barbecue cookout, and Easter egg hunts. They're doing gun safety classes. They're doing all sorts of things to kind of endear themselves to the local communities in swing states and places where Republicans win and places where Republicans don't win.
Yeah, that was something that was interesting to me in your piece, too, which is, one, they're working to shore up states that are trending redder or keeping or maintaining red states by having these community centers in Florida and Texas so that the Democratic coalition doesn't really come back in full force, but also in places like Philadelphia, where they feel that they could make some inroads and that Pennsylvania is a bit more up for grabs. Plus a community center that you highlight at the start of your piece, the one in North Carolina, that's for indigenous Americans. Can you talk about some of your reporting on that specific center as well?
Yeah. So the reason I thought this one was particularly interesting is because it's the only center in North Carolina. North Carolina was a state that obviously Democrats thought they were going to win statewide. They, you know, Cal Cunningham was running for that Senate seat, and they expected him to win. They actually thought they had it in the bag. And they also thought Joe Biden would win statewide as well. They ended up losing by less than 100,000 votes there. So it was really narrow. And one of the areas that delivered this victory to Republicans was Robeson County, which is in the state's southeast. It's very rural, it's very poor, and it's very diverse. It's more or less one-third Native American, one-third Black, and one-third white. And it's a place where Democrats had historically really dominated. I mean, the Lumbee tribe there voted Democratic almost, you know, has voted for Democrats for decades. The Black population there has voted for Democrats for decades. And Trump managed to win that county significantly. And that was a big change. And so I thought that that was an interesting county because it's a bellwether county. It tells you a lot about how Democrats have, you know, lost ground in places. And obviously the Republican Party looked at that and said, you know, winning with Trump on the ticket is one thing, but we think we can convert these voters not into Trump voters, but into, you know, day in, day out Republican voters. And that is a tough conversion. And if they can do that, obviously they're talking about winning elections, not just this year, but in 24, 26, and 28.
And frankly, this is just the infrastructure that the Democratic Party kind of refuses to engage in. The fact that it's shrouded in secrecy is something I want to get to in a little bit, but I'm fascinated by and scared by Republicans' willingness to target these specific districts and areas, understand that there's an opportunity here. And it's very quintessential Republican in that they will exploit the potholes of the U.S. social safety net. We have insufficient public spaces, insufficient community centers without a policy solution, but they will use that by setting up, I would imagine, these relatively cheap centers to push for more acceptance of Republican politics fairly cheaply. And that's electorally, it could definitely pay dividends for them.
Right. And what's so interesting is, you know, it's the sort of grassroots on the ground stuff that you would associate with Democrats. And, you know, the interviews that I did for this piece, you know, people were talking about how it really borrows from the Bernie Sanders model of sustained organizing. Having that perpetual on the ground presence is something that, you know, left-wing organizers have advocated for forever. And, you know, the sort of constituent services model really goes back to something the Black Panther Party did with the free breakfast program. It's something that, you know, Tammany Hall Democrats did in New York years and years ago. And so, you know, it shows you the Republican Party has this willingness to basically try anything. And it shows you how creative they're willing to be. And when you're on the ground every day saying, you know, like, hey, you can hang out here. We have food here. You're welcome here to bring your family. We know, you know, it's tough times are tough in certain parts of the country. And there's no Democrat there to say, hey, wait a second, times are tough because of Republican policies, or times are going to get worse for you if you vote for them. There's no contest there. And that's a really effective, you know, way to reach people and to bring them aboard.
In terms of the North Carolina community center that you reported on, was there any Democratic infrastructure there to combat some of this?
No, there was not. And there were two interesting conversations I had. One was with Charles Graham, who is running for a House seat in North Carolina, 7th District. He had this ad that went viral on Twitter about how the Lumbee tribe in the 50s had, you know, fought off the KKK, and like it was a call to you know, to like racial cooperation and for the betterment of society. And when I talked to him, he was, you know, he was really alarmed by the center. He was like, I grew up in this town. You know, everyone I know is a Democrat growing up. And now the stuff that I'm hearing out of the center is very concerning to me. And, you know, he's basically the only Democrat left there, and there's no help on the way. And everyone else around him, all these other Democrats have lost. And so they've kind of washed out. And so he was very concerned. The other person I talked to was the head of the local NAACP, and he had you know, a number of concerns about this as well. He said that, you know, that the RNC was basically taking advantage of the racial tension between the Black and Native population there, that they were making it worse, that they were seizing on that to bring Native voters into the fold, and that he had no support from the Democratic Party at the state level or the national level, and that he felt like the party had basically abandoned the county and, you know, left him and you know, Black voters behind.
Can you expand on that concept of the not the concept, I guess, but the dynamics within that area in terms of black and white voters, but also Republicans trying to seize a certain opportunity with Native voters?
Yeah, certainly. I think that, like, the best way to think about this is that Robeson County, things started getting the story kind of starts with NAFTA. So NAFTA really blew a hole in the economy there, where there was a textile industry. People worked for, you know, Converse shoes or making shirts for Ralph Lauren. Those jobs went away. So you have this kind of gaping economic wound that was left by a policy that was championed by Democrats. And so you have these kind of material needs that are created. On top of that, you have this recent tension between the black and Native population there, where, you know, in 2020, there was a Black Lives Matter march in the county, that was, you know, 150 people, was a small march. And it was set upon by actually a counter protest of Native people who were heavily armed, and they were 300 or more in number. And they ended up scattering the protest rather. And so you have this antagonism between the black and Native population there. So, you know, it's racism in a way that we don't necessarily think of, maybe right away when we talk about, you know, anti-black racism being a white, you know, white issue. It's you know, it's the sort of thing where the Republican party can make an appeal, a racially inflected appeal there to the Lumbee, and it's been really effective. So the combination of sort of these economic factors and then also this social and racial element has kind of set the stage for this perfect campaign to bring those Native voters into the fold as Republicans.
And so you traveled to the Pembroke Community Center, the RNC Community Center there. What did you find? What were some of the more striking details? I mean, there was a Herman Cain poster that I saw in your piece, among other things. I mean, just some anecdotes from what you found there.
Yeah, sure. One of the things that I ended up going to three separate centers. The funniest thing to me is there's a framed portrait of Ronna McDaniel in every center, with a quote from her that's kind of like a, it's kind of like a Mad Lib. It's like the Republican Party welcomes, you know, insert racial group here. And it's like at this one, it was Republican Party, you know, embraces Native Americans who are welcome to join us. And then I went to a Black American center and it was, you know, same thing, but with Black Americans and one for Asian Americans. That was really funny. The thing that was really striking to me was that there was programming at this place nonstop. I mean, I was, you know, I couldn't find anything online that was going to give me a schedule. So I just kind of showed up and figured, you know, hopefully in a couple of days I would see something. There was stuff going on every single day. And that to me was really notable. Just, you know, the sort of like willingness to be there on a sort of regular basis. And the other thing that was notable to me was that the organizers at this center were really young. There were three organizers who worked for the RNC. All of them were forbidden to talk to me. But they were 20, 19, and I think in their, the third was in her early 20s. I mean, we're talking about, like, you know, people that we associate again with Democratic politics, Gen Z kids who are, you know, who are very much the future of this country. And they were running the show, and they were really active. And I was really pestering them, trying to get them to talk to me, and they wouldn't do it. And, you know, at some point even they tried to seize my notes because I'd been writing stuff down that I was hearing. And then eventually, you know, they would turn me out, or refuse to let me in or whatever. That was kind of the story every time.
And to turn to the Democratic, the DNC and the, just the broader Democratic infrastructure, how you can contrast it with that is that it's not like, as you write, the DNC does have, you know, community based funding for some of their projects, but a lot of it disproportionately goes to ad buys, which is very different from the way that it seems like, and again, this was shrouded in secrecy, as you say, but Republicans are conducting their operation. Can you talk a bit about that contrast?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, so there's a sort of two elements to every campaign. There's the air war stuff, which is the ad buys, the TV, digital, radio, et cetera. And then there's the ground game stuff. And Republicans have always dominated air war. I mean, they just have a, you know, a machine that the Democrats can't match. And they're better at ads. They're, you know, they're better at that messaging. Democrats have always kind of felt like they have the advantage on ground game and meeting people where they are and, you know, union halls and this sort of door knocking stuff. Republicans basically since 2012 have been really dedicating themselves to having a more robust outreach campaign, doing ground game and doing it better than Democrats do. And Democrats, I guess, just from the conversations I've had, have really been focused on, you know, trying to get better at air war and doing ad buys. And, you know, I asked a number of people about this, like, you know, is this a concern that these community centers are allowing them to do outreach, you know, on an everyday basis all year long? And their response was basically like, you know, we can reach these communities with targeted ad buys. You know, we have the ability to contact these people on TV and digital. And I think, you know, that to me has got to be a huge red flag because, you know, in a place like Robeson County, a lot of people don't even have broadband internet. I mean, yeah. It really is. You really can't reach people like that. Like it's ridiculous to suggest that. And also, you know, 3 weeks before election day, every single ad on TV is a political ad. They're just not going to get through to people, you know, 3 weeks before the election and change their mind about something. So, the sort of focus on ad buys and the emphasis on that from the Democratic side, I thought was, notable at the very least. I think if you're a Democrat, probably a little bit alarming as well.
Yeah. Professional Dumpster Fire is the name of the person who wrote in, but they said that that's their username. The community center move is really concerning. Here in Pennsylvania, community outreach programs are really effective if you spend the time and money to commit to reaching out to people. The Democratic Party in PA is super out of touch. And given our Democratic gubernatorial candidate is so out of touch with his constituents statewide, it doesn't bode well for our future. I'm concerned because, you know, the Democrats have zero infrastructure in many southern states, in many red states. They don't think long game wise. They also, frankly, there's like a lack of understanding of like those kinds of dynamics specific to the community that you've outlined there. One, the broadband internet thing that's, you know, Democrats have to understand the dynamics of that community, but also just there, I feel like, and this will be, you know, my final discussion point with you, there's a sense of not taking voters for granted. Yes, there's that. But also, since like the early 2000s, Democrats have kind of been coasting on their perception that demographic shifts will always help them and will always be in their favor as we become eventually a majority-minority country. And I think it's been a cop-out for doing politics. And that's what your story really highlighted to me.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's exactly right. And the thing I think, you know, we always say, you know, Republicans are so under duress that, you know, the white population in this country is getting smaller and smaller and they can't win. At a certain point, you know, these voters will die out. But if you look really closely at the returns on the 2020 election, you see that actually Democrats have an incredibly fragile racial majority, or their majority is based on these incredibly fragile alliances. And, you know, Native voters are a very small percentage of the American electorate, you know, compared to Latinos or Black voters. It's, you know, it's much, much, much smaller. But the Native vote alone in Wisconsin and Arizona could have changed the outcome in both those states for Biden. And, you know, Biden, if he had lost a substantial number of Native voters in either one of those states, would have lost Wisconsin and Arizona. And that's, you know, then we're talking about an election that's going to be decided by one or two states after that. You know, it's the margins are so narrow. And, you know, I think some people would say, you know, these efforts can't change the hearts and minds of tens of thousands of people. Well, they don't have to. They only have to change a couple thousand here and there. And we're talking about an election that Trump would have won. And, you know, that to me, I think it is really sort of the most striking part about this is, you know, Republicans don't have to win majorities. They only have to win a little bit here and there. And that's what they're seeking to do. And they're seeking to do it in a way that doesn't just win, you know, in November. They're seeking to do it in a way that's going to deliver them victories you know, in years to come.
Alex Salmon, staff writer at the American Prospect. You can read his excellent piece, the RNC's Ground Game of Inches in the Prospect. Thanks so much for your time today, Alex. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much, Emma.
Of course. All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we will be joined by Joe Eskenazi. We are back, and we are joined now by Joe Eskenazi, managing editor of Mission Local. Joe, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me. It's a real thrill.
Of course. Well, unfortunately, I wish we could be speaking under better circumstances after the result of what happened to Chesa Boudin. Sorry if I'm butchering
Boudin.
That. Boudin.
The like Sanford. The bread.
Good. the San Francisco DA, what is your reaction to the successful recall vote, successful in terms of the people that were funding it? We can get into that in a bit.
I'm getting paid by those people too. Yeah. I'm not surprised at all. And no one should be surprised. Every poll leading up to this had Chesa Boudin struggling, and the toss up that came out on the nape of the election was a text poll that didn't have Spanish or Chinese. So not exactly, rocket science there. It was always going to be difficult. You tell me if I'm getting a little bit too in the weeds in San Francisco, but it was very clear that there was going to be a hearty no vote from the city's more conservative enclaves, and it would have to be balanced out by overwhelming yes votes in the more liberal parts of the city. And that just couldn't happen. Contrary to popular understanding, low turnout, and it was very low turnout. We're at 26 or 27% right now, which is not crazy for a midterm election. But low turnout wasn't necessarily Chesa Boudin's enemy, because his likeliest voters were the people who were, high information, high propensity voters. So if just the bare bones people showed up, he had a chance. But as it just wasn't going to happen for him. For more than a year, there's been a very well-funded campaign that has been saturating and cementing the storyline that San Francisco crime is out of control and that this is due to Chesa Boudin not prosecuting anyone. And by the time the paint had dried on that, he couldn't unmake it.
Yeah, we Sam had Akilah Lacey on yesterday to discuss some of these dynamics. But, I'm hoping that you can flesh them out as well. You can never be too in the weeds for MR. So when you mentioned those wealthier enclaves, But the Republican donors, yes. The real estate industry, yes. But
I mean, not necessarily the wealthier. I mean, the wealthier enclaves of San Francisco is something of a misnomer. Most all of San Francisco is wealthy at this point. But the parts of San Francisco where Chase Aboudin was destined to lose are going to be the Sunset out, you know, which is heavily Asian, and he was polling horribly among Chinese people. The Marina, which is a joyous continuation of post-collegiate life in San Francisco, where people do vote conservative by San Francisco standards. So he was going to lose there in District 2, the Marina, District 4. And he'd also lose badly in District 7, which is a kind of a leafy green suburb in the midst of the city where there really are, stately manses. And he was just not going to do very well there. So he would have to make it up on the east side of San Francisco, which does tend to vote more liberal. On the other hand, this is the third election of the year for the east side of San Francisco, and the east side tends to show up less in elections than you know, established homeowners, and especially more so this time when I believe voter fatigue has set in.
That makes total sense. Thanks for fleshing that out geographically in terms of the regions. Now, can we go into the specific industries and moneyed interests that helped fund this campaign for over a year?
For sure. The majority of the money against Chase Aboudin was coming from very wealthy donors and a particular political action committee that has been active in San Francisco pushing quote-unquote moderate causes and sending out hit pieces against the more left-leaning elected representatives. Now, it would be a misnomer and an oversimplification to say this was a Republican recall. You could qualify a recall in San Francisco with Republicans, but you couldn't get anywhere once you did. In San Francisco, Republicans are kind of reminds me when I was at UC Berkeley. People who are coming to UC Berkeley to say they're a Republican, they have there's a chip on the shoulder of the chip on their shoulder. And in San Francisco, it's kind of similar. The people who come out and actively are Republicans in San Francisco are eclectic to say the best. So they're not an active political movement here. If anything touches a Republican in San Francisco, you don't want to have it, right?
Well, that's, sorry to cut you off, but that's mm-hmm. what that is a mistake in terms of, I think, the messaging about this recall is because Republicans, they're ornamental to a degree, but you can mm-hmm. still be a right winger and be a Democrat, or you can be a moderate and you can be funding these very undemocratic recall efforts. And that seems to have been the case. There were some Republican donors, but much of the institutional backlash against Boudin was, just other Democrats, too.
Well, I mean, Democrats are a big tent. And I don't know how winning a message it is. It has not turned out to be a winning message to point out who is funding things in San Francisco. And it may not work anywhere. At some point, you have to say what you're for rather than who's funding the opposition. Even though, for journalists, this is very important. Endorsements are great, but endorsements is just, political backslapping. I always look at who the money is coming from, and then you can tell where things are coming from. But that's not really a great way to convince voters. I have a column up this morning. It is a modified version of the column that I had, kind of buried in our election coverage yesterday. And if you have a way to post to it or not, whatever's the case, if you go to Mission Local, it's there.
And, we'll post in the description.
Yeah. What I wrote was, San Franciscans' message to America is this is us. So when you're saying that you could be a corporate Democrat, I don't know that it's a winning political message to say that San Francisco's notion of liberalism is vacuous and superficial and does very little for the most put upon among us. And that criminal justice reform, if people vote reactively because of a statistically anomalous and non-existent crime wave, separate and apart from people's lived experience, or if people are upset about property crime and not taking into account, our absentee police force, there's nothing you can do about that. Chase Aboudin has many faults and he did not handle himself well politically. But if the motivating factor here is driven on a drummed up, propaganda campaign, our notion of liberalism is vacuous. And I think that's been the case for quite some time. It has always rankled. I think it rankles a lot of people to see San Francisco homilies about abortion rights or Black Lives Matter when we really cannot look after people in our own town, especially, I may not be the ideal person to say it, but San Francisco's Black population is extremely put upon, is microscopic and shrinking due to economic pressures and longstanding neglect. And our police arrest Black people at around 10 times the rate they arrest white people. And so, criminal justice reform does not mean we all have to suffer to make up for some kind of penance for things that we did in the past. But the notion that criminal justice reform, the notion that not putting people in jail reflectively and punitively is the way to go, that this makes us safer is not true. That never really got through. That never really got through. Nobody messaged that on either side. And people voted with an inchoate anger. And inchoate anger is justifiable considering the conditions in San Francisco to a point, but it's not a great way to run a government. And it's not a great way to have an organized voting push.
Well, I mean, you mentioned the kind of manufactured crime wave, as it were. Violent crime is not up, but yet I would guess that and perhaps you have polling data in San Francisco that would back this up, that the majority of the population there, specifically the voting population that voted on this recall, probably believes that. I would imagine it's higher among property owners versus renters.
I don't think
as
people
well.
Care. You I don't really? Think people care.
Okay.
I don't think people care about the statistics. And I think that, you know, we like to make fun of Red America for not believing in science, but like nobody believes in the stuff that doesn't agree with them. So in this particular case, I can show you statistics that that indicate that the crime is down, and crime is unambiguously down statistically. But, you know,
but it's what people believe, right?
It's people's lived experience and what people believe. But then again, also, like, crime is not uniform. Violent crime is down. Some signs of murders are up, you know, like, but it's still historically low. Violent crime is historically low. Property crime is very high, and it's certainly higher than even it's reported, because nobody reports property crime because nothing happens. And it's been that case way for a while. There's kind of a selective amnesia. You know, when I was an editor at San Francisco Magazine in 2016, it was already a very old story that San Francisco was the car break-in capital of the world. And, you know, we needed to put a freelance journalist through the paces before he, you know, we invested in his story about car break-ins, which, you know, turned out to be a great story where he followed along the police that were putting together cases, et cetera. But 2016 is a long time ago. And so car break-ins is not a new story. If people are voting out Chesa Boudin because their car got broken into, it shows an incoherence. So people, again, you know, the crimes that were up unsettled people during the pandemic. There were more home break-ins. People felt violated. Chesa Boudin was not an empathetic figure. And anybody who's arguing your feelings with a stat sheet that said statistically what you're feeling doesn't make sense, that's not a great political look. So you have to find ways around that. Reassuring people that the stats are good and all of that felt phony to people because San Francisco's street scenes are so wretched. And especially because we're such a wealthy city, it feels so wrong.
Yeah, I mean, but that's inherent to the issue there. I mean, but politically, he clearly made some mistakes, but I am interested in fleshing out, I've said that a few times now, I'm interested in expanding on some of the many layers of opposition to him that were coordinated in many cases and quite aggressive. You talked about some of the donors, the money behind it, but let's talk about the police, because he wrote a piece a few weeks back in the lead up to this recall about how Boudin had to rent a U-Haul for an arrest because police were not cooperating with his office. Just to give people a sense, can you tell that story? It's an indication of how the San Francisco PD was seemingly sabotaging him from within.
I don't know if it was even that coordinated or if they just didn't show up and do the job. So, you know, we can look at that. But to tell the story, and the fact you've said flesh it out three times means I should flesh it out. And I apologize there. That's
no,
something
it's
I can
okay.
do. And we will do that. But to tell that story, Chesa Boudin's office had a sting operation in which they traced a large number of electronics break-ins, in which, you know, one of the reasons that there's crime in San Francisco is that there's such great wealth disparities. And if every third backpack you steal has a laptop in it, it's a profitable thing to do. And a goodly number of those backpacks are being traced back, fittingly enough, to a Quickly boba tea shop in the Tenderloin. Quickly, which is a boba tea chain, has an interesting history in San Francisco politics. A city supervisor here was jailed about a decade ago for extorting a Quickly of $40,000. So certainly more great product placement for Quickly. In any event, the man was running an electronics fencing operation internationally, sending stuff to Ukraine, to Europe, to China, out of his Quickly shop, right? So the DA's office had this thing set up, and finally they realized we can make the arrest, but we have no way to transport this man. And there's hundreds of boxes of stolen equipment, and we need a truck. And when they asked the police to cooperate, the police said no. And so the DA's office had to have federal agents come in who have, you know, a car with the cage in the back of it, et cetera, to transport the arrestee to jail, and had to rent a U-Haul, like you and me moving out of college, to pack up the boxes of stolen laptops and phones and other electronics. So writ large, I think that you're getting, and Emma, your through line is correct here. It points to a dysfunctional and spiteful relationship between the police and the DA. But that's been the case for decades. Before Chesa Boudin got here, they would not give DA George Gascon a win, even when he had good ideas on how to stem the flow of drugs into the Tenderloin. There was a acrimonious relationship between Kamala Harris and the police, famously because she would not opt for the death penalty when a man shot dead a police officer, which is, you know, one of those rare occasions, though we've just seen it yesterday, where a politician is punished for living up to their campaign promises. And of course, Terrence Hallinan, prior to Kamala Harris, indicted the entire SFPD command staff. So there's always been an acrimonious relationship between the police and the district attorney. What we're seeing now is the police arrest rates are so low, 58th out of 58 California counties, and by a lot. You know, it's like looking at the Kansas City Royals. They're in last place by a lot, right? So you really have to wonder, is there a work stoppage, or are they just underperforming? Or is it a distinction without a difference? Mm. And the fact that now there's a huge push to give the police more money, to give them more manpower, was this a protection racket? Or was it just incompetence? Or was it a distinction without a difference? It's really hard to say. Either way, no matter how competent or incompetent Chesa Boudin is or was, he could never do the job with this kind of arrest rate. You know, I mean, San Francisco police clear one crime out of every 12. They clear one property crime out of every 16. You cannot, if we're going to be haranguing the DA over what he does on the every 12th or 16th case, you're missing the point. It just doesn't matter.
It's an abusive relationship with city police and elected officials in many regards. I mean, we're here in Brooklyn and in Manhattan, or in New York. It's well documented how the NYPD doxed Bill de Blasio's daughter. If you said, because he deigned to say that they should maybe wear body cams, but it doesn't necessarily matter what you give them; they're still going to be acrimonious to you unless you're as far right as, I don't know, say Rudy Giuliani. This seems like that's kind of the path that the mayor of San Francisco, London Breed, is going down, where she seems to be appeasing the police, and correct me if I'm wrong, in San Francisco as a way to appeal to the constituency that wants a tougher on, or imagine constituency, I'm not sure, that wants tougher on crime policies. What's your take on how she responded and her relationship with Boudin and her relationship with the police?
Boudin was a very convenient person for the mayor for 2 years. He was like a lint brush. Everything stuck to him. And most of the things that San Franciscans in polls say that they're upset about and should be upset about, because things are not great here, are things that are not the DA's purview. If you're upset about homelessness and street drug use and filth, that's something that the mayor has a far more central role in. And if you're upset about crime, and, you know, then that's also something that the mayor has a far more central role in, because the mayor essentially operates the police department and the chief of police operates at the pleasure of the mayor. So many of the things that San Franciscans are most upset about are under the aegis of Mayor London Breed. Mayor London Breed played fast and loose with what she would do with Chesa Boudin, kind of intimating, I've made up my mind on the vote, but not really coming out and saying one thing or another. It was all very coy, but you know, he was a very convenient lightning rod for her.
She has no excuse now. She has no excuse now. So but good luck.
But she is the exact opposite of Chesa Boudin. Boudin turned out to be a shit finder, and everything stuck to him, whereas London Breed has come through with a Teflon coating. San Francisco has, you know, a long-running federal corruption probe of, you know, very good friends and associates and intimates and appointees and close proximity people to the mayor have gone down. You know, there's going to be a sentencing at the end of the month of her former romantic partner who may or may not spill. You know, it's these are all things that she's come through remarkably well on. San Francisco, almost everybody will say that things are not going well here. But, you know, the connection between and the mayor needs to do X has not been made.
What do you attribute that to?
That's a very deep and problematic question. I think I'm going to dance around this just a little bit, but I think that the mayor has a very authentically personal story. And I think our mayor has, you know, is a very powerful and strong and inspiring leader. And I think that San Francisco feeds off of that more so than the nuances of policy. And I think, if I may be so bold, a city that has economically banished its black population is not in a position to punish its African American mayor, whose story is something that is well and truly and not cynically inspirational. And I think that is also a factor here. And I think it makes everyone very leery of offering even, you know, a modicum of criticism.
Yeah, that makes sense. I just want to see if you could talk a bit about the relationship between real estate groups and developers in San Francisco and the tough on crime stances, because from my outside view, people tackling homelessness, houselessness from a systemic perspective where there's guaranteed housing, where there is affordable housing that might encroach onto their profits, that is a scary future or proposition for these real estate developers. Is that clear in terms of why they were so aggressive in, or why they have been so aggressive in tamping down progressive candidates, people like Chesa Boudin, in their funding and, you know,
I don't know about that.
Okay.
My intuition is that, you know, first of all, these people could have gotten involved in the DA's race on the front end, and then we wouldn't have had to have a recall. They didn't. It was notable that the masters of the universe who control San Francisco politics did not get involved in the DA's race in 2019, and Chesa Boudin squeaked it out against Susie Loftus, who was the mayor's appointee. And one of the reasons that he squeaked it out was the heavy-handedness of the mayor, putting her into the vacant DA spot 24 hours before ballots dropped, which was seen as a crass flex, and a lot of people voted for him probably out of spite. Susie Loftus is a good public servant and a genuine person, and that was a bad look, right? So, but to get back to your point, there are warring political bodies in San Francisco that are very complicated and arcane. It involves unions and neighborhoods, et cetera. And, you know, by irradiating Chesa Boudin, you're not just irradiating Chesa Boudin and criminal justice. You're irradiating an entire political movement, and you're pushing along your team. And also, you are probably also either doing the bidding or going along with other people of a like mind. And I also think that it's hardly a coincidence that the person who was spearheading the successful recall movement is a real estate lobbyist and certainly knows who to ask for money.
That does not seem like a coincidence whatsoever. Well, I really appreciate your time, Joe Eskenazi. We're going to link to your piece, or at least both of your pieces.
One of them is election coverage, and you know, our team at Mission Local punched above its weight again, and thanks to everyone there for working very hard and going out to the events.
It's an excellent piece. So congrats to your whole team in terms of the great reporting, although, you know, the outcome is unfortunate, but it's a good lesson for the left to learn, I think. Joe Eskenazi.
I think it is, and I think also it's time for San Francisco to take a deep look and say, what is it to be a liberal? Is that us? And why am I doing what I do? And do I get to be a liberal even if I do things that don't add up to being liberal on paper? And what does it all mean? And if people are fine with it, they're fine with it. You're allowed to do whatever you want.
Yeah. Well, let's hope that there is some soul searching. Joe Eskenazi, managing editor of Mission Local. Thanks so much for your time today, Joe. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Emma. Anytime.
All right, folks. With that, that will be the wrapping up the first hour of this program.
I have to I have to give myself an L.
Why?
Because I touted the McConaughey.
Yeah, so we were kind of debating before the show. I was like, "Am I too cynical about McConaughey?"
This is epic.
Oops!
But it appears that he did a photo op with Henry Cuellar, who has an A rating from the NRA, immediately after that speech. So.
My guess is that his politics are a little closer to Cuellar than Cisneros.
I just don't know how you speak about dead kids like that and then go talk to an NRA guy.
He doesn't know.
I mean, that's the thing. That's the problem. That's always been the problem with McConaughey. Is like he's a deadly mix of, I think, genuinely wanting to do well, having a folksy personality, but like not having any like sort of the desire to get politically savvy enough to actually do something.
I'd be curious what Griscom's take is on
Griscom is how I found that picture.
Okay.
On this feed, so.
All right. Speaking of Griscom, what's happening on Left Reckoning?
Kurt Hackbarth, we're talking about AMLO and the America Summit and how America is a big time loser. So bitcoin.com/Left Reckoning. We're doing summer streams, so our post game will not be members only tonight. We're going to be streaming it on Twitch. So public post games all summer, or at least for June.
Whoa.
So, but if you want to support us and our ability to do that, go to patreon.com/leftreckoning.
Okay. Well, that's tonight, right?
Tonight, 8 o'clock Eastern.
Awesome. I was just like, my brain feels like it's Thursday, but it's not.
Same.
646-257-3920. We will see you in the fun half.
3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts!
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who?
What is up, everyone? Nomi Keen.
You did it. Let's go, Brandon.
Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false. No, I'm sorry. Women's...
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But, dude, you want to smoke this 7-8?
Yes.
Me? Is this?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm gonna go start life.
You libertarians.
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed him!
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I wanna say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$3 trillion. Sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less.
But let me say this. Poop.
Call it satire. Sam goes with satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we seen you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, sun's out, guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled, folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late, and the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye.